I'm Zoe Williams, and this is Counterpower, the podcast for global solidarity. Some say we're entering a new age of hard power where might makes right and despots carve up the world between them. Here on Counterpower, we've got other ideas. The despots are facing rising resistance across the world, and our job is to build these sources of counterpower. The podcast is brought to you by Stop Trump Coalition, Another Europe is Possible, and Global Justice Now, three organisations at the centre of the new global resistance. The first year of Donald Trump's second term is over. That's only three more to go. Are you counting the minutes to his departure? If so, you've got about 1.5 million still to come. What could possibly go wrong in that time? You might ask. Well, if the first 12 months are anything to go by, an awful lot. The US president has bombed seven countries. He organised a kidnapping of a foreign leader, gave fulsome support to Israel's genocide in Gaza, rolled out the red carpet to Vladimir Putin, and endorsed many of his imperialist goals in Ukraine. He launched a chaotic trade war against the rest of the world. And at home, Trump embraced the US tech oligarchy while claiming to put ordinary Americans first. His vicious militarized police, ICE, have terrified immigrant communities and operated largely outside the law. In Minnesota, earlier this month, they shot dead a mother of three children. And if all that wasn't enough, Trump bulldozed an entire wing of the White House to build a ballroom named after himself and used his political position to brazenly enrich his own family. But the world and the people of the United States are resisting. Last year, America saw some of the biggest protests in the country's history. Here in the UK, we've played our small role too. The Stop Trump Coalition and more than 60 other campaign groups brought tens of thousands onto the streets of London to protest Trump's second state visit. And today, I'm joined by two people who are at the heart of the movement. Zoe Gardner is from Stop Trump, and Alyssa Elliott is from Indivisible London, the first international chapter of the main US resistance movement to the Trump White House. Together, we take a deep dive into Trump's first year and where the global movement goes next. Okay, look, I want both of you to describe how you know each other and how I know you. So, Alyssa, you go first.
I met Zoe almost a year ago exactly at a Stop Trump Coalition organizing meeting after a Ukraine protest. And it was my first protest and then my first organizing meeting.
Oh, wow. You've taken to it like a fish to water.
And I heard Zoe speak on a panel and I said, that is someone that I want to know and work with.
And how, when did you come to the UK?
7 years ago. I came for drama school.
You came for drama school. Mm-hmm. And you weren't thinking I'm going to leave my country. It's going to descend into fascism. I'm going to fight it from another shore. And it's going to feel kind of quite lonely. And then I'm going to meet some solid dudes. That's not what you were thinking.
That was not the plan. He was president when I left. So it was kind of might as well leave for now. And then I was thinking about moving back. And he became president again. And it was part of my decision-making process to stay here because I thought that I would be able to be more vocal from here than there.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. That's quite stark. Zoe, I remember the first time I met you, which was in one of those brilliant anti-Brexit campaign meetings we used to have. Like, I think a year and a half after Brexit was voted for, maybe middle of 2017, beginning of 2018, and Another Europe is Possible meeting, which you were already very focused on the migrant crisis, the crisis of narratives around migration and how it was impacting our politics. That's kind of been your life for more than 10 years.
I mean, that's all I've actually ever done, really, because I discovered this particular focus for my political interests while I was still at uni, actually. So I've only ever worked on migration rights. Essentially, I've worked for a bunch of different NGOs and I've been involved with, as you say, Another Europe is Possible since the start because Brexit was so clearly about not reducing immigration. That was the lie that was sold to us. It was about reducing the rights of immigrants in the UK. And what we've seen is that, of course, it didn't reduce immigration. You might have heard a little bit about that lately, but it did reduce. So everybody who is here now does not have the freedom of movement rights that they once did if they're working, on farms and in care homes and so on. That used to be predominantly done by people with much stronger rights under EU protections, and now it's not. And obviously, we've just seen that continue, and it informs my opposition to Trump and why I wanted to be part of the Stop Trump Coalition as well, because all of this horrendous politics, essentially, at the moment, from, you know, the consolidation of wealth in the hands of a few and the dispossession of the many, you know, who have faced a cost of living crisis and who face a democratic deficit and who face all the crumbling services of the state that we should be able to rely on. All of that and the colonialism and the foreign policy horrors are all justified through this lens of anti-migrant hate and racism. So I feel like I'm at the core of everything.
Yeah, you're at the coal face. It must have been interesting because it was very obvious during Brexit that the kind of xenophobia and the misinformation were being fused into some very powerful argument. But yeah. to watch that accelerate and cross-pollinate with neo-fascist ideas and actions has been quite striking, actually.
It's been horrifying. And it's, I think I'm not at all alone. Obviously, colleagues in Stop Trump, colleagues in Indivisibles, colleagues in Another Europe, and colleagues across, you know, the entire left have been able to see the direction for quite a long time. But I think that it is, in terms of that, there is a huge degree of complacency in our commentator class, in our political class, a failure to recognise the amount of anger and the desire for change, any kind of change, really.
Yeah.
Frankly, among the general population, that's what gave us Brexit. That's what gave us Trump the first time around. It's what gave us Trump the second time around, and it's what is likely to give us Farage as well. And I think, you know, like, even just a few months ago with Stop Trump, we made a video and we were calling out the Trump regime as fascist, the ICE raids as racist, violent, you know, disgraceful, Gestapo style. And people, we had a really strong negative reaction. People telling us we were being, you know, alarmist and sensationalist and overblowing things. And just a few short months later, you know, I don't think any of them would say that any longer.
Okay, so there was this idea when Trump came in that he would be a peacemaker. Obviously, that was an idea promulgated by himself. He's claimed, I believe, to have ended 8 wars. He also, obviously, was gunning for the Nobel Peace Prize, ironically. And a lot of people see the Venezuela kind of exploits as his response to not having got it. What on earth is... Alyssa, tell me what, describe for me how wildly off this peacemaker image is.
I mean, it's just as absurd as we can all see that he would consider himself a peacemaker who somehow deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, and he's talked to the new leader of Venezuela into saying she would share the prize with him, which they have let her know is not allowed. But he is wreaking havoc on the entire world order. I don't see a way for even him to twist that into being the peacemaker that he ran on being. And that was a core part of the support from his base, was this already flawed America First policy. But at least in that, it was no more interventionist wars. And he's completely gone back on that.
I mean, Zoe, this to see a president stand up and describe reality as the opposite to what it is, does this strike you as like a core component of fascism or just a delusional narcissist?
Can I go for the secret third option of it being both? Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, we all know the quote from 1984, isn't it? You know, the party's final command was that you should disregard the evidence of your own eyes and ears and just believe what they tell you. I think it's part of this wider movement that we've been seeing. This, you know, we talked about with Brexit, it being a post-truth world. We are constructing sort of at least two alternate realities here. There's the reality that we live and breathe in, the one where we have seen with our own eyes the warmonger, the genocide supporter that Donald Trump is, and the one that is being constructed for us. And, you know, possibly a bit too deep or above my pay grade, but I worry also that with the advances in AI and the creation of more and more convincing AI videos as well, that we are moving further and further into a world where there simply will be parallel potential realities to subscribe to. And that scares me.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of so chilling that I was lost for words for a second. And I think, you know, we're definitely seeing, you increasingly have to appeal to a kind of trusted third party to tell you what's real and what isn't. And when that third party is the BBC, that kind of comes with its own problems. But, you know, at least you trust that they're going to verify a video. Yeah, talk to me, Alyssa, about Iran in this instance now, because there is, you know, there's noise coming out of the White House that they're going to intervene. Mm-hmm. All of us are slightly wrong-footed by it, because for the obvious reason, nobody wants to support what is itself an authoritarian regime, but nobody wants to see another interventionist war. Mm-hmm. What do you foresee happening? What impact do you think it will make on American politics?
A question I'm not sure I have the answer for, but I do think that we have finally seen world leaders start to realize that they have to start taking Trump seriously when he threatens things like this, when he threatened Venezuela, when he has threatened Greenland, and now threatening Iran. We truly have to prepare as if he is going to do what he's going to do, because he has proved he now will. And like you said, we don't want to be supporting the regime in Iran, but it also doesn't need to be fixed by the U.S. bombing it. And it's, you know, a similar situation to Venezuela. We don't want to support a dictator, but also he shouldn't be taken out without any legal basis by the U.S. president.
I'm really interested, actually, to hear from, you know, all of the many, many, many people who, when, you know, we woke up and Donald Trump had gone in and kidnapped Maduro from Venezuela and bombed the place and said he runs it now, said, well, this is great news. I mean, I remember Mike Tapp, who is one of my least favorite government ministers, you know, going out and saying he's really pleased on, you know, the Today program on Radio 4. He's really pleased to see Maduro gone because that was such a terrible regime. I haven't heard from him since about the fact that the regime remains in place, mm-hmm. right? Maduro, the figurehead, is gone, but his vice president is now in charge. Every political prisoner is still in a torture cell in Venezuela that was before. So it seems to me that this has come out as the worst of all possible worlds, right? The repression and the lack of true democracy and human rights protections in Venezuela has not been addressed. But yeah, Trump is going to take the oil.
So do you think, I mean, I'm kind of looking at three possible rationales. And again, you can choose all three of them at once. One is that America takes control of the oil interest, although that does sound like it's going to be much harder than he thinks. The second is that he's signaling to other leaders that the old rules no longer apply, that he can simply kind of wade in and kidnap you, which would make sense of the kind of removing the figurehead, but not removing the regime. He's not kind of interested in removing the regime. And then the thing that everybody's talking about on Blue Sky is this idea of Primat der Innenpolitik, that it's a kind of, I don't know what era of German politics it comes from. Let's say maybe the Nazi era, but it's, you know, no foreign policy is actually about foreign policy. It's all about telling your own supporters and your own opponents domestically what you're about and how far you're willing to go. Now, does that strike you as having an effect? Is it having that kind of dead hand effect on the Democratic Party?
That is a great question. I can't say what effect it's having on the Democratic Party, really. I'm not seeing a lot of their really strong response to this, just with everything else that they're currently fighting. I think, honestly, a lot of the foreign policy is falling to the side of the U.S. news cycle, as the things that are happening on U.S. soil are taking most of that up. But I do think it is also obviously harkening back to this spheres of influence. Donald Trump thinks he will control the Western Hemisphere and that is somehow his right. On Wikipedia, he's listed as the acting president of Venezuela.
wow.
Yeah.
That's bad.
Mm. Yeah, so it's, yeah, he didn't want to remove the regime. He wanted to be in control of the regime.
Yeah.
And it is interesting, again, you know, because we do think that the base that voted for him wanted no more foreign wars, right? And so, you know, you would imagine that with such direct total abandonment of core principles like that would severely impact his popularity. But, you know, Trump himself said back last time when he was president that he could shoot someone in the street and he wouldn't lose support. And I think that there is a worrying truth to that, which is that essentially he can justify it. Any intervention, any action, however he wants. Nobody in the international community, well, not nobody, actually, that's not fair, but certainly not the countries that should be and certainly not our country, are standing up to him and countering his narrative. And in the US, as far as I can tell, people are just willing to say, oh no, black is white now. And actually that's happening here to a degree as well. Because if you look at, I'm sorry to sort of segue, but I find this very interesting. And you look at the digital ID card policy that the government introduced and now is rolling back on here. It had strong support. Digital ID, like having a mandatory ID system in the UK, had very strong support in this country among the public until the day when Keir Starmer announced he was going to do it and Nigel Farage said, that's really bad. And suddenly you see the polls just go, whoop! And everybody who supports Nigel Farage changed their mind and decided that they didn't support the idea of having ID cards in the UK because the leader told them that that was their opinion now. And on a much more intense scale, I think we're seeing that in the States.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's quite a terrifying thought, isn't it? I mean, do you, just to remain on US politics for a second, because it is having a long tail effect in UK politics for sure. I feel like we're often, you know, whether you're talking about Greenland, whether you're talking about Venezuela, whether you're talking about Gaza, we talk a lot about what this means for the world order, about institutions that we've grown up with, that we've lived all our lives under, falling apart because their fundamental principles will be corroded. So, you know, whether it's NATO or the EU, or, you know, nobody will survive somebody who doesn't, an America that doesn't want to play ball. But what, on a more grassroots level, how are you supposed to react to this?
Well, I think that's difficult. It's difficult to react to foreign policy in the same way. It's not got the same, we don't have the ability to respond in our communities in the same way. And you know, there's been inspiring resistance to ICE raids and so on. We'll come to that in the US, but they can't act in the same way about Venezuela or Iran or wherever it might be, Greenland. So it does hamstring you. And obviously we saw, you know, huge opposition, huge protests against foreign policy decisions in the past and against warmongering in the past. So obviously I'm thinking about the Iraq war and those huge protests, which ultimately were ignored. Yeah. You know, and the same in the US history also of campaigns against the Vietnam War, which, you know, it did end eventually, but like there was huge opposition to it for a really long time that was essentially just totally ignored. So it is interesting, and I think I've seen James Schneider put forward this position. We don't actually live in a democracy at all in terms of foreign policy in the UK. You know, you look at the unpopularity of the Gaza position as a perfect example. But in general, the public opinion is just not followed in terms of foreign policy. And I think that that may also be the case in the States, although I'm less familiar with the public opinion there.
I think there is one thing to add just from a book I'm reading at the moment, Hope in the Dark by Rebecca Solnit. And she's talking especially about the protests to the Iraq war in the States during the Bush administration, and that we often fail to recognize what could have happened and was possibly prevented by that public outcry, that things were delayed, that maybe tens of thousands of lives in Iraq were actually saved because certain things didn't proceed as they were going to.
Oh, absolutely. I just want to make clear, never saying it, there was no value to those
protests. Oh, yes, absolutely.
And does she think that that was a direct result of like public protest?
Obviously, can never say if it's a direct result, but that we shouldn't lose sight of the things that could have happened, because we never know truly what was actually prevented, but to remember that there is still purpose, and even if it seems that public opinion isn't followed in foreign policy, that it likely does at least have some effect that is still worthwhile.
I mean, to add to that, I think if you look at the effects of the anti-Iraq protests in the UK, they had some starkly negative events of making people, because a million people went on that first march, and it had the effect of showing people who didn't go on many demonstrations that they didn't work. You know, it's like people who are kind of novices at protest were like, oh, well, that took a day and did not make any difference at all. And they were astonished because a million people is a lot. But whether it's 10,000 or a million, if you're not going to be listened to, you're not going to be listened to. And I think also it kind of, it was like it had a real appalling effect on trust in politics, because not only was the Blair government not acting the way anybody thought a Labour government would act, but they were completely unresponsive, and they were, you know, they were meant to be so pluralistic and democratic, and they were actually anti-pluralistic and anti-democratic. A lot of the people who voters liked about the Labour Party left the Labour Party on that basis. I would say, looking back, I would want to see us learn some lessons from that era, but I don't know what the lessons would be, because the lesson you take from that cannot be, oh, well, let's not go out and protest at all. But it's got to be some way of finding it, of not losing hope in your own hopeful act, in the kind of devastation of your own hopeful act.
I mean, I think we never know, do we, what is, and this comes to, I mean, there was such a moving vigil organised for Renee Nicole Good by Alyssa primarily the other day, and in your speech, and you said you never know which is the one act that is going to actually be the one that people turn around and say, oh, that one, that demonstration changed everything. But that demonstration, whichever one it is, or that action, whatever one it is, will never happen unless we are consistently organising, consistently going out, consistently making ourselves heard and doing what we can. yeah, absolutely. The lesson cannot be that we shouldn't bother doing this. The lesson is that we will have to continue to do this, and that the struggle is ongoing. And at some point, there may be a moment where there's a watershed, but that watershed will never come if we're not there doing the action.
I feel as well, from a kind of narrative stroke media perspective, because foreign policy is like big boys table stuff, groupthink takes hold really fast, even fast. You know, there are people who would weigh in on kind of ID card policy or education policy, who, as soon as you get to talking about Gaza or Iran, are like, oh, well, if the foreign secretary said it, then that's probably the best idea. And I wonder if there isn't energy to be fruitfully used just preventing that kind of groupthink in our own political environment. Because I don't, you know, you saw the news this morning that Keir Starmer is thinking seriously about joining Trump's panel on rebuilding Gaza. Now, it's despicable. It, from so many angles, it's so despicable, because Trump approaches this scene of total devastation with a realtor's eye, and has been quite explicit about that. And if a prime minister of the United Kingdom, who was not that long ago a human rights lawyer, will join that project, it makes so many ideas we have completely meaningless. Somebody have an idea about how to put internal pressure on whether that's acceptable or not.
I think internal pressure on Starmer there is. That's certainly true. I think Starmer's days are numbered. And it makes a lot of his decisions even harder to comprehend. But he obviously feels more comfortable, actually, in the international space than domestically, which is interesting. And his party feels more comfortable challenging him in the domestic space, and doesn't really know what to do about the fact that, you know, they hate Trump, but they feel like, and to an extent it's true, of course, that we've put ourselves in a position where it's very, very difficult to stand up to Trump. That we have certainly not put ourselves in a position where we have to suck up to Trump or participate actively in his horrendous colonial project in Gaza or anywhere else. So, yeah, where's the backbone in Labour is the one of the perennial questions that I think the left is asking itself at the moment.
Yeah.
Hi there, I'm Nick Dearden from Global Justice Now, and I've got a small request. Counterpower isn't just about conversation, as great as that is. It's about turning ideas into action and building real community power. That's why we have a simple pledge to you, our audience. On every single episode, we'll leave you with something that you can do, big or small, to catalyze change. Whether it's the latest big ideas or the movements you need to check out, you'll find them on Counterpower. But to do all of this, we need your help to launch the project. We know it's got great promise, but to get it off the ground, we need your support. We're aiming to raise £8,000 to kick off this exciting project. To support our launch, please go to the crowdfunder linked in the show notes. And one more thing. Whatever you do, don't forget to subscribe, like, and follow so that you never miss an episode. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review.
We're going to come back to both kind of migration as a muster point and UK politics and looking into the future on future episodes, because these are very important. But right now, we're going to move to the Epstein files, because it's the story so far, they were ordered to be released. There were heavy redactions. There were definitely pages missing. There's a huge amount of rumours about what pages actually are missing. And now they've simply stopped releasing. The Trump administration has simply stopped releasing the information, which is, you know, if it were not for everything else going on, you would say it was a pretty serious breach of their own law. How much of an issue is this for Trump's base? How much of a galvanizing issue was Epstein and in his paedophile conspiracy for Trump's supporters in the first place? And how likely are they to Zoe's point that Trump said in the last campaign round he could shoot somebody and it would just make him stronger? How likely is this to actually damage him? And can anything damage him if this can't?
It has done significant damage to the size of his base. He's even lost the QAnon shaman, which is saying something. This is someone who literally stormed the Capitol on January 6th in the insurrection. He no longer supports Trump because he won't release the Epstein files. This was a major thing that he ran on that had a lot of support. And now that he's so obviously obstructing the release of these files, we only have 1% of the files released. There are still 2 million documents that they are over 2 weeks late in releasing. So it has done massive damage to his base and support. Whether that will translate to him and MAGA being taken out of office has a lot more to do with election fairness than it does actually how much support he still has and will have as more comes out. And it will be even more damaging than the things that have come out. Because he is noted, even in the small amount of documents we have, Trump's name appears 1,500 times. And there's an email from 2020 from the federal prosecutor informing his colleagues that Trump appears in Epstein's flight logs many more times than expected, including 4 flights with Ghislaine Maxwell.
So let's put a pin in future election fairness, because I do want to come back to that. Zoe, do you think, I mean, in a way, Trump is such an obvious candidate to hang out with Jeffrey Epstein that I find myself having surprise fatigue. But does there... Is there something that one could usefully build from this transparency or this failure of transparency? Or do you have to like sit back and watch your enemies make a mistake, sit back and watch the MAGA coalition fragment?
Yeah, it's hard to say, because there's such an extreme amount of just stating the black is white and, you know, hypocrisy involved with the conversation about Epstein. Epstein is, I mean, you know, we talk about him like everybody knows. I had to actually listen to a podcast and just be like, oh, wow, it was like horrendous. Like the scale of it, the number of girls. Anyway, he was a monster. And yet when we talk about paedophiles and grooming in the UK, in the UK political scene, your brain doesn't go there, right? Even though, you know, Peter Mandelson getting rehabilitated on the BBC, cozy little chats. Oh, I'm so sorry. Now he's sorry. You know, we have so many people with power, obviously, Andrew, linked to him, and we're you know, bowing and scraping to Donald Trump, who is so clearly linked to him. And at the same time, yeah, if I say paedophilia and grooming, then you don't think Epstein in the UK. No. You think of the racist narrative about Pakistani communities in the UK. So this has been this whole narrative around the safety of women and children has been co-opted, and it makes it very difficult to, especially in the sort of media space where you have like 30-second clip, to cover the nuance and the complexity of it and to bring it round to a framing that is actually useful for taking down the powerful people who have done wrong.
That's so true. I mean, I look at the Grok situation where, you know, you've got our actual government saying it's a matter for Ofcom when it's just image, you know, child sexual abuse material. It couldn't be clearer.
Yeah.
Or it's kind of manufacturing that. It is quite a kind of problematic moment. It's a moment where we cease to be able to agree on even the fundamentals of what's good and what's bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean the child sexual abuse imagery is the like worst of it, but it's also just, you know, degradation of women in public life as well. The creation of non-consensual sexualized material depicting women. And this sort of being treated as though it's not a fundamental part of how our politics and the spaces in which we are able to speak out and have impact is shaped. Of course it is. This is very much about silencing voices of dissent against the right as well. It is about silencing women's voices, women who are more likely to have progressive politics in the UK. It is about shaming women out of public spaces, as well as it is about, you know, the harm done to children. So it's a whole big disgusting mess. And frankly, it is also contributing to that lack of trust in politics that, you know, is the theme, the overarching theme of everything. Because we can see the government just isn't treating Elon Musk as others would be treated who were responsible for the systematic production of this kind of imagery. It, you know, you're above the law because we're afraid of Donald Trump. Full stop.
Yeah. There's definitely a kind of separate category for the oligarch class. And it's quite, I mean, it is, I think that something to think about for the future would be, where do you see political environments, like in what countries do you see political environments in which that kind of thing is downright rejected? And probably you would go to Scandinavia for those modes of arguing, and there might be, and there almost certainly is something to learn from that. Just to come back and do very quickly, the midterms obviously are this year. They obviously, Trump is already making noises of, if we don't triumph, then we'll all be thrown in jail. It's that kind of victim bully projection, and makes you think he's going to throw people in jail. Do you seriously think there's a chance of electoral tampering or electoral distortion or some kind of, you know, prevention of the free and fair execution of democracy in November? And if so, I mean, are you an outlier in thinking that, or is that quite a commonly held view?
I definitely think there will be attempts to influence votes, whether that looks like actual tampering with ballots. I wouldn't go that far at this moment, but it's also not out of the realm of possibility. But what they are already doing is even more massive gerrymandering, although this is being fought by blue states who are fighting fire with fire and gerrymandering their states in response to eliminate some of the red seats. And then, especially as an American abroad, what personally affects me is that Trump is trying to restrict mail-in voting, which applies to all Americans living outside of the United States, including military. And they've already changed the rule based on postmarks. It used to be that if it was postmarked by the date of the election, it would be counted, and they're trying to make that no longer happen. And also with intimidation, we're already seeing ICE out in the streets violently intimidating and attacking citizens and immigrants, and they are more than likely going to also be at polling stations in trying to intimidate people from coming out to exercise the right to vote.
Okay, so I do want to move on to ICE, because it's such a stark moment, and it does look more like a police state. And it is probably the most concrete iteration of, you know, we've all been saying neo-fascist movement since Trump got in, but it's probably its most recognisable element of totalitarianism that you can be shot in the head. Alyssa, again, tell me about Renee Good and the impact you think it's having, and the mobilizations abroad as well.
Yeah, so as we've mentioned, Renee Nicole Good was shot by ICE in the head on January 7th. She was not obstructing an ICE raid. She was there as a legal observer. She was obeying a demand to remove her car from the situation. And then the man shot her point blank in the head. We have seen it on the video. And then we've also seen the white is black line from Donald Trump and J.D. Vance and Kristi Noem telling us that the officer was lucky to escape with his life when he was clearly never in any danger. And I think what they were hoping from this, because while it could be seen as, you know, a failure of training, the man who shot her is in fact a firearms instructor for ICE.
Wow.
He knew exactly what he was doing. And this is part of how they will be moving forward. Since this murder, ICE agents have also been recorded responding to other peaceful protesters who are observing their raids, saying, haven't you learned your lesson?
Oh, my God.
So this is a severe escalation of violent tactics by ICE. Minneapolis has been under constant siege since January 7th. They are deploying chemical weapons near schools. They are abducting parents from the school drop-off lines. They are now going door-to-door, ripping people from their homes. They are following DoorDash drivers who are having to take refuge in the homes of their customers they're delivering food to. It is truly on an extreme level that I think is not making its way out of the country, and maybe not even completely out of Minnesota unless you're specifically looking for it. So this is something that everyone on the right side of history in the States now is mobilizing against. There have been massive protests every day since January 7th. And people are mobilizing around the world as well, which we will need to continue to do because from the words of the residents of Minneapolis, they are effectively under military occupation.
When we come back, we'll put the lens back on UK politics and ask what our own MAGA movement has in store for us. Zoe, you've devoted your career to looking at migration and how attacks on migrants operate both in narratives, in fact, in democracies. Were you surprised by the acceleration of ICE in the US? Were you surprised that would be the frontier, the front line?
I'm sorry to say that my only surprise is that it took so long
really?
For someone to be shot in these kind of circumstances. These inadequate men have been given impunity, very little training, and automatic weapons, and they are motivated by a truly extremist, racist, and frankly Nazi ideology. And the demonization of not just migrants themselves, which is at the utter extreme, but of those who would stand with their communities and stand up to this kind of repression has been absolute. And as we've discussed multiple times, just simply bears no relation to material reality. And so we've been saying this all along, never think it can't happen here, never think mm-hmm. it can't happen there, never think it is happening. It is happening. And what I've, been reading about authoritarianism as much as I can lately, as I'm sure many people have. And, I think we ask ourselves, why didn't people resist? Why didn't people resist? People always have resisted, mm-hmm. always, against every, repressive regime from Iran to the Nazis to everywhere, right? The danger is that they resist too little, too late. Mm-hmm. And as this authoritarianism gathers power and gathers confidence and gathers the willingness to act again and again with brutal and evil force, then it will become more and more dangerous for people to, it's obviously extremely dangerous to resist right now, but it will become only more dangerous to resist. And that is why it's so important that we in the UK learn these lessons and see that that is where, they're not hiding it. Nigel Farage, Kemi Badenoch, both of them saying they want ICE-style raids in the UK.
They've actually said that.
They have said ICE-style raids and deportation forces in the UK. they're not hiding that that's where they want to go. And what's really important is that obviously that we resist before we get to the point where we might be, you know, under lethal force for resisting.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's echoes of it here as well. You know, like, look how they're treating the protesters, again, you know, in support of the Palestine Action prisoners. You know, that we are already being repressed, right? And for now, you know, we have the opportunity to push back against this. And it is important that we communicate that as strongly as we possibly can, because even right now in the polling, if you look at even Reform voters and Nigel Farage supporters, the majority of them say they disapprove of Trump. They don't want ICE-style raids in the UK. Not really what's happening, not what they see, not you know, mums being shot in the head, mm-hmm. right? Like, the majority of Reform voters don't actually want that. And yet, for some reason, putting a British flag on it seems to make it feel different.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've got the government, you know, this last week announcing that more raids than ever. Right. The British raids are, you know, they are the same thing. They are the same thing. They are the same families being torn apart, same people being locked up without access to, you know, legal counsel, without access to a fair trial, people being returned to dangerous places. We're not as extreme as the States yet, but we are definitely on the exact same road.
Yeah. And when you look at, I mean, one thing that I've noted, that I've thought watching the mobilization in America and watching it here, you know, like since Kendrick Street in Glasgow, or there was Peckham resistance a couple of years ago, people don't like it. They don't want their neighbours taken off the streets, and they don't have to be progressives to not like it. They will genuinely do a kind of reverse Stasi neighbourhood network to stop this happening and to derail the attempts. And I wonder how much, you know, how important it is to kind of amplify that, those actions, and how possible it is to kind of bring them together, or whether they are by definition hyper-local.
Yeah, I think that local communities are best placed to respond in the moment, in the way of those examples of people preventing raids and deportations from happening. And people are doing it all the time, right? People are sharing, there are networks, anti-raids networks, that share information about where raids are happening, and sharing information because, again, we know that the ICE agents in the States are acting totally unlawfully in most cases that we come to our attention. Here in the UK as well, they press against the legal, they rely on people not knowing their rights.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to stay and give your information to immigration officers here in the UK. They don't have the right to search you or, you know, to take you in unless they have a good reason to suspect that a crime has been committed. So all of this stuff, and it comes also from the, you know, stop and search and anti-stop and search movement,
yeah,
which
course,
has been quite effective in the UK at, like, informing people about their rights and informing people also about their rights as bystanders,
mm-hmm.
and what we can and should do. Because, I mean, I think we've all probably experienced this very uncomfortable feeling of walking past something happening where there's a police officer questioning probably somebody belonging to an ethnic minority and thinking, that doesn't feel quite right. And I wish I could do something, but it's awkward because we're British, but it's also, you know, we're frightened and we can't allow ourselves to be frightened.
Mm-hmm.
And so being empowered by that knowledge and those networks that are sharing that knowledge and just practicing it a little bit every day. I mean, I remember when we were organising the Trump protest and we went to Charlbury, this small village in the Cotswolds where JD Vance was coming. And there was a brilliant response from the local community. People wanted to come out and protest it. But we also had a lot of people being really frightened. I mean, we were going along there to hold some placards and to say, JD Vance, we hate you, go away, right?
Yeah.
And people were genuinely frightened that, you know, we were going to be doing something illegal, that the police were going to come and crack down. Like we got quite a lot of messages like that, and we had to do a fair bit of reassurance work just on that level of protest.
Yeah.
People have learnt to be afraid of their own rights to stand up to this kind of authority, and that can only snowball and get worse.
Yeah. Okay, I think we're getting to the point where we have to draw this to a close, but just as a heads up, you know, what we've got to pick up on in podcasts to come, and not, and with a variety of different experts, is exactly as you say that kind of working on not being frightened, working on network building, working on you know, casual day-to-day knowledge and expertise about what's going on, and working on, you know, that not being hopeless. Is that a fair summary? Or do either of you think that there is other stuff to work on?
No, I got it. That will take up plenty of time.
Yeah. There's always more, but that's, I think, a comforting thing is that there's always something you can do.
There is always something you can do.
Yeah. And anything that you do, even if it's not necessarily the perfect thing, and even if some smart ass on Blue Sky or Twitter or wherever tells you that actually, maybe, you know, this wasn't so smart because X, Y, Z, you know, that doing something is almost always better than doing nothing, mm-hmm. even if it seems like something small.
Exactly. And it literally might just be talking to your neighbor and building those local communities.
So that's all we've got time for today. I hope you enjoyed it. Counterpower is a fortnightly podcast produced by Another Europe Is Possible, Global Justice Now and Stop Trump Coalition. Our aim is to bring together experts and activists to talk about global justice and inspire you, our audience, into action. So if you don't know our networks and organisations, look us up, get involved. There's lots to do. And remember, you can support Counterpower by hitting the link in the show notes for our crowdfunder. We're aiming for £8,000, so please help us kick off this project. And whatever you do, don't forget to like, subscribe and follow Counterpower. Maybe even leave us a nice review. We'll see you again in 2 weeks.